Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, I use and really highly recommend GoToMyPC to remotely access another computer. You know, maybe you haven't tried GoToMyPC because, it seems too complicated. But let me tell you something. It's easy to set up, and it's really easy to use. First, all that you have to do is you have to sign up for a free trial. Go to GoToMyPC.com/podcast. And make sure that you're at the computer that you want to access it, download it, and set it up. It takes about 2 minutes. Then from any computer you're at, log in to GoToMyPC.com with your secure password and click the connect button. You can go to GoToMyPC and get a 30-day free trial. So visit GoToMyPC.com/podcast and check it out. I really highly recommend it. Again, it's GoToMyPC.com/podcast for a free 30-day trial. This podcast is also brought to you by Audible.com. The internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. Get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Log on to audiblepodcast.com/investor. Well, hello there. Welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Happy Memorial Day. If you're listening to this on the weekend, we put this up a little bit earlier so you could have it through the weekend. And hopefully you're taking some time off, spending it with your family, maybe even doing a little research, getting ready for the week, but spending some downtime, relaxing a little bit. I got to tell you, it's important every once in a while for anybody to, you know, recharge those batteries. And what a great time it is to have a day off when most of the world markets are closed and we can spend some time relaxing. So I hope you are having a good time and taking some time off. It's episode number 110. I have a great episode lined up for you. We have two great guests today lined up. Just yesterday, I spoke with Michelle Leader. She is the founder and the editor for footnoted.org. Now, if you haven't seen this site, it's something you need to take a look at because she really delves into and gets into the whole aspect of, you know, the 10Ks and the various annual reports and finds all the little nitty-gritty things that are really tough to find. For example, you know, is that CEO spending an extra $150,000, $200,000 on a luxury item for himself and burying it in the footnotes or in the endnotes or in some other type of area that you really wouldn't know about? Is there some kind of a securitization that we're not sure about? Well, she uncovers it. We're going to talk to her, and I think that's something that you're really going to get something good out of because she has a lot to offer. Then, as I had promised you, we have another friend of mine. We call him the Guru Investor. His name is John Reese. And he has a book out called The Guru Investor, and he follows the, I guess, not only the teachings, but the methodologies of some of the great investors of our time and of other times, Ben Graham, Warren Buffett, Ken Fisher, to name a few, Peter Lynch. And I'm going to spend some time with him. I would like to find out in this newer environment that we're in when buy and hold is changed, let's say, the idea of it. Is it something that he's changed? Has he changed his methodology? Something that he's worked on and quite frankly perfected and done a great job with for many, many years. So we'll find out what's going on with that. But I thought we'd start out with a couple of pieces of information and some things that we need to be aware of. You know, first of all, the earnings season for the U.S. is pretty much drawing to a close. And I wanted to give you some stats that I thought you would find of interest. So overall, here's some numbers that you need to know. The overall growth rate of earnings in the S&P 500 from last quarter to this quarter, you know, first of all, clearly has been much lower. What we found was that about 9% of the overall, we saw a 9% increase, a surprise, if you will, compared to what analysts had predicted. That's why we saw such incredible movement on stocks with such low analyst projections and predictions that a lot of beats came out. It was about a 10% beat on earnings overall. We saw year over year a 35% reduction in earnings. And it looks like we're going to see that over the next 2 to 3 quarters as well, if estimates are even anywhere nearly close. Out of the total grouping of the S&P 500, the worst performing sector was clearly materials. You know, obviously in the construction area and in the area of building and everything involved in the, you know, the deflation situation that we've seen happening over the last few months. I mean, it, you know, it stands to reason that that is the hardest hit. Interestingly enough, though, one of the best sectors that has not performed, though, is healthcare. They held up very well throughout this environment, comparatively at least. And I thought that was interesting because we really haven't seen that. And the question is raised, what's happening? Well, it's obvious that there's some confusion, concern, and questions in the air because we are been talking about nationalizing or socializing the healthcare system. And that being the case, it's putting a quite a damper on the potential, the top end, the opportunity for many of the stocks within that sector. So even though they are doing much better and holding up much better and, frankly, a safer bet these days, the safety goes right out the window because we don't know what's going to happen when it comes to, you know, new legislation that's going to be passed. But probably the biggest story of the week has to be what has happened with the dollar. This week was not a green shoots week. It was back to green ooze, okay? And there was a lot of concern in many markets with what is going on with the, probably best said, the reckless spending by our government. I mean, the money is flying around all over the place. And, you know, I understand that we need a rescue plan, stimulus plan. We need to back the banks as much as possible so that we keep our financial system in place. But come on, I mean, the numbers are enormous, and it's finally caught up. It finally caught up about Wednesday and Thursday. First of all, Standard & Poor's came out with a comment that the sovereign debt of the UK possibly would be downgraded. I mean, just wow. Who ever heard of, you know, one of the core countries, the I don't know, the group of 10, let's say, you know, having a questionable rating on their sovereign debt. Just an amazing story that's coming out. Maybe a little late, by the way, as usual, but nonetheless, amazing that they have the nerve to actually do that. That's, and then came out the second part of it, which was the concern that maybe the debt of the U.S. would be downgraded. The dollar got absolutely obliterated against the euro. It was $1.40. The yen came up very strongly. The Japanese finance ministry came out with a commentary on Friday. They said, you know, we're not going to intervene in the currency, even though it's very strong right now. And, you know, that just kept on pummeling the dollar. In addition to that, the Treasury decided not to buy as much. And we saw rates yields come up. Now, we talked about, I believe we talked about probably 2 weeks ago, the trade utilizing TBT, the double inverse 20-year Treasury, so that when rates eventually start coming up or prices go down, however you want to look at it, we would have some profit potential here. And we thought that we were in a dramatic, close to a bubble when it came to treasuries, and because it was forced. It was a forced bubble by the hand of the Fed and the Treasury, where they're pressing yields down in order to obviously help out the banks, help out lending, help out borrowers, etc. But that would have to eventually end. And this week we saw probably the biggest move in TBT that I've seen in a while. A great, great position. Gold, wow. Gold broke through 950 on the way to 960. And amazing that we're finally seeing this inflation trade become a reality, because for a while it was like, okay, well, there's money being spent and, you know, where, what's happening? Is there inflation or not? And we kept on seeing pricing come down and the deflation discussion. But you know what? Food prices are moving up. The ag positions that we have are doing tremendous. If you haven't looked, take a look at Mosaic and Potash. Take a look up at the ETF MOO. Look at DBA, DBC. Look at what happened with crude last week. It is unquestionable that the moves that have been done by the central banks and governments around the world are having an effect. Even though they don't seem to have an effect that's dramatic because it's happening all at once and all together, it is having an effect. I did a study this week. We actually put it up on the website. looking at what kind of numbers are we talking about, actual numbers, and where are they coming from in terms of the metal and energy consumption and imports for China. What I found was really interesting. First of all, you know, the number one country's stock market for 2009, do you know what it is? It's Peru. Peru, rich in copper, been doing a lot of exporting of copper. Copper's come up dramatically. Copper's used in all sorts of building. We talked with Dennis Gartman about that last week. And, you know, what's happened is that country is just reaping the benefits, just like Brazil is as well with their natural resources. And even Russia is coming up very nicely. You know, the BRIC countries are doing very, very well, and particularly because of the consumption, whether it's stockpiling or consumption or just buying at cheap prices. You know, China is being very smart and very strategic. And when I looked at where all the metals are coming from, what I found was very interesting. There's a small amount coming from the U.S., but generally speaking, most of it is not. You know, we're seeing a lot coming from Brazil and Peru and South America, but I found it very, very interesting that we're not seeing a lot of trade with the United States and China. And I wonder if there is this, even though they don't want to talk about protectionism, because that's one thing that really was a problem back in the Great Depression. We went into a protectionist mode. And that was really bad. And today, with the world being such a smaller place, I mean, it makes a lot more sense not to be. But you know what? It seems that we're seeing a little bit of hinting of countries trying to do their best at spurring on domestic demand, because there is no external demand. And if that means a little bit of protectionism, well, so be it. We have a lot of things on the table right now, folks. A lot of things that are you know what? It was great when we saw that giant run-up, and it was great when we saw that it looked like the world wasn't ending, but now we're in a put-up-or-shut-up mode. Now we're in a show-me mode. We need to see earnings and growth. We need to see something more than the hope that things are getting better. We saw a jobs number again at 6:30 last week. That was not good. We saw the Philly Fed come out. That was not good. We saw housing numbers come out. That was not good. Generally speaking, last week was not good. The only thing that was good was at the end of the week, Sears came out with some number that, to be honest with you, I have no idea how they managed to come out with a number that was a positive 40 cents when the expectation was for a negative 80 cents for earnings. The only thing I can tell you is this. Same thing happened when we saw GE come out with numbers and Caterpillar, because you know what? They're using the mark to market on some of their assets and some of their debt. Don't forget, Sears has a big credit card and a big, if you will, a loan business. So they're doing some mark-to-market in there, and they did a big, you know, tremendous amount of layoff and cutback and no inventory builds. Well, they could have done a little bit to enhance their earnings. I would venture to say that's going to be a one-time event for them. So keep that in mind. We still like the agricultures. We have decidedly started spinning our portfolio more towards a short position. So, you know, we do a lot of work in the area of neutral, and it helps us to smooth out returns. During bizarre times, as we saw, it's helpful when markets are moving against you. When markets are moving in one direction and you see things that just don't make sense, it doesn't help so much. It's kind of frustrating. But nonetheless, we much rather have a nice, smooth return over time than, you know, making 30%, losing 30%, making 30%, losing 30%. You know, that's very difficult on the emotions. It's very difficult on you. I mean, I'm sure you don't like that. Anyway, I thought we would talk about that. I also wanted to mention that on the site we have a report we just put out talking about the changing face of home ownership. How the average age, the demographic of those people, anybody who owns homes, I mean, compared to, let's say, I don't know, 40 years ago, it's a lot younger now. And think about it for a second. I don't know when you bought your home, if you have a home. But usually what would happen is, traditionally, you know, the usual story, what you would do is you would get married and you'd get a home and you'd be in your 30s or so when you're settled and when you got your first home. But what's happening now and what happened over the last number of years, younger people that were not settled in life were getting homes. And I wonder if that led to some of the problems where they needed to be more mobile, you know, to grab the job that they needed. And at the same time, the inability to pay for things because of the lack of being settled in life and, and a little bit more secure and seasoned in their job, maybe that caused some of the problems that we were seeing right now. But so anyway, pick that up. There's a report that's on the site. We'll put that in the show notes as well. And what I thought we'd do is we'd just get into this discussion. We'll start off with our guru investor and get him all queued up and talk with him. And then we'll get into our discussion with Michelle Leader, who is with footnoted.org. The one thing I want to mention to you is if you haven't tried it so far, if you like podcasts, I got to tell you something. Audible.com. Now, here's a really, really neat, just a neat service. You know, you're doing it right now. You're listening, obviously, to audio. You're listening to the spoken word. And that's what you do, and you like it. So why not think about picking up a book on tape? You could pick up a subscription to the Wall Street Journal on tape that's delivered, you know, very early each and every morning. You can, you know, join up and actually try audible.com, get a copy of a free book. You can get my book for free, as a matter of fact. All you have to do is simply go over to audiblepodcast.com/investor. And what you do is just check it out, sign up. If you want to cancel, you can cancel at any time. But I would encourage you, if it's something that you enjoy, and I enjoy learning and listening, and you know, when my kid gets in the car, he puts on the music all the time, and I'm always listening to talk radio, and he's looking at me like there's something wrong with me. But I enjoy it. I mean, I listen to a ton of podcasts. I listen to AM radio. I'll tell you the truth. I listen to the news. I listen to you know, Bloomberg Radio, etc. And I really enjoy also listening to books on tape. So check out audible.com. It's audiblepodcast.com/investor. I'm sure you'll like it. I'm sure you'll like it. When we get back, we're going to be on the horn with the Guru Investor. Stick around. Thanks for joining me here on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We'll be right back. And today I have a special friend of mine, John Reese, who is the CEO of Validia Capital and Validia.com. He's also the author of The Guru Investor and also was one of my co-strategists on the MSN Strategy Lab. John, how are you?
Fine, thank you, Andy.
So I thought we would kind of get into the discussion about, you know, you're all about gurus. And for those of you that don't know John has made a study of guru investors. You know, who is the kind of the ultimate in investing, like a Buffett and a few others we'll get into. And you know, what do they do and how do they choose the investments that they choose? And he manages money to kind of work within those boundaries of what would the gurus do? Did I summarize that pretty well?
Yes, pretty good.
Okay. So I thought we would talk about first, like, how do you pick who's a guru and who you're going to include their strategies for use in your whole entire strategy?
Well, I have looked and researched who have been the top experts over the last 50 or so years who have disclosed the strategy, and usually disclosed the strategy in writing, and have a verifiable track record in their strategy, mm-hmm. and have enough clear steps in the disclosure of the strategy that it can actually be implemented within a computer program.
Right. That makes sense. Because if you're just hearing what they do and how they've done, you don't know how to really replicate it.
There are quite a lot of people, quite a lot of books on the market with interesting philosophies on picking stocks, but only a tiny fraction of those have the long-term track record associated with it.
Okay, so give me some of the names of the people that you have and that you've included and you've researched over the time that you really like.
Sure. Benjamin Graham, Peter Lynch, David Drennan, Marty Zweig, Warren Buffett, of course, James O'Shaughnessy, Joel Greenblatt. Those are to name a few.
That's interesting because they all have different ways. I mean, Jim O'Shaughnessy is an absolute, pretty much a purist when it comes to doing quantitative screening. And Peter Lynch is more of a kind of a fundamental and what's what you know kind of thing, right?
Yep.
Warren Buffett does the whole smattering, kind of old-fashioned, old-style investing. Graham style, I think, a little bit, right? Value-oriented?
Yes, although he progressed past what Graham was doing. But yeah.
Well, you include derivatives, you definitely got past what he was doing. Not to pick on Warren. But so now you have these gurus, and let's take one of them as an example. Let's talk about, let's go Benjamin Graham, because, I mean, he's the first he's
sure.
the father of all this, right? So give us an example of what a Benjamin Graham strategy would look like.
Okay. As an example, maybe we can apply this to an actual company. Schnitzer Steel mm-hmm. Industries, which is the recycler of metal and not ferrous metals.
I think it's symbol SCHN.
Yes, okay, that is correct.
Right, same one, okay.
Basically, how can I basically start this? One of the things that Graham does is make sure that the stock is not either a technology stock or a financial company, which I think is very, very interesting. And the wisdom of that clearly shows up today and for the past 2 years with financial companies.
Can I interrupt you for a second? How did Benjamin Graham, from what year was he in the 30s, know about technology?
Even back at that time, there were some companies that were on the leading edge, and that is what made basically a technology company. There were certain chemical companies, mm-hmm. Xerox back at that time.
Okay. Or, I got you.
Even IBM was starting to peak up.
Okay.
So the next thing that you would look for is that the company had to be an adequate size. And when you scale up for the fact that quite a number of years have passed, the cutoff of that is it has to have a sales of greater than $340 million a year. So that screens out a lot of small companies.
Mm-hmm.
Looks to see that the current ratio, which is a very good measure of the liquidity of a company, is greater than or equal to 2. So companies that typically meet that are considered usually financially sound and stable. And another really key criteria turns out to be looking at the long-term debt in relation to net current assets. And that is, by the net current assets, you take the cash on hand and your inventory and subtract out what you have to owe or pay, accounts payable, et cetera, loans for that particular year, and what you have left over is net cash. And you compare that to the long-term debt, and he wanted to conservatively see that that net cash could easily pay off whatever long-term debt the company had.
So right there, what you just said is a definition of when we're looking at balance sheets, because you're not really talking about anything to do with growth and earnings right now. We're really talking about balance sheet fundamentals.
That's right.
Okay.
And but by the way, with growth, it's very interesting. He was pretty mild in growth. He only wanted to see over a 10-year period a growth of about 30%, which is about 3% per year.
Mm, which wouldn't cut it by most investors' standards today.
That's right. But nevertheless, there's a lot of big cleverness for that. There are certain stocks that may not grow these fast 15, 20, 30% per year, yet nevertheless, their stock price has a high percentage chance of doing that or more.
Yeah, I got you. Okay, good. So, but the thing is, these so far we're talking about companies that are stable, at least from the aspect of they have a solid foundation.
That's correct.
Not a lot of debt. You know, there's companies that are going to be very very cash rich and sound potentially. So, I guess the point is though that also they're not fly by nights. I'm just kind of just thinking through this here. They're not fly by night companies. They can withstand a big storm of some sort, down years in here there because they have the cash, and they don't have a big overhang of debt.
That's right.
Okay, I got you.
And the last few criteria that are very important is it's not just enough to pass that, but the price of the stock in relation to certain fundamentals is also very, very key.
Mm-hmm.
So he used a couple of different ratios to look at that. One is the very traditional price-to-earnings ratio.
Uh-huh.
And he's very unusual. Rather than looking at the price-to-earnings over the past 12 months, which is what virtually everybody and every financial columnist and site does, he averaged the earnings over the last 3 years, and that was the earnings in his price-to-earnings equation.
So it smooths it a bit.
It smooths it quite a bit mm-hmm. to get over the cyclicality.
Right. Interesting.
And he basically wanted to see that that was not greater than 15.
Mm-hmm.
But the second criteria he applied was a price-to-book criteria.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than specify a particular cutoff, he was actually very clever in that the price-to-book times the price-to-earnings ratio can't be greater than 22.
Price-to-book, let me think this through. So now we have the 15 right at the edge of the price-to-earnings.
Right.
And a price-to-book. Now, if the price-to-book was high, obviously, that would mean, once again, that there wasn't a lot of really sound fundamentals underneath the foundation, if you will. So he's trying to make sure the company has the low price of the book, so that it's not tremendously away from its book value, and that the earnings are low, so 22. So that's pretty neat. So it's 1.3?
Well, 1.4. If the price of earnings was as high as 15, you'd have 1.45 or so.
Mm-hmm.
But if the price earnings was, let's say, 7.5, then you could actually have 3 times the price of the book.
Right. Interesting. I gotcha.
But nevertheless, these basically select, in his model, deep value companies that seem to be financially sound.
And do they usually, sometimes you get these outliers in there? Do you get something that just is really not, when you think of value, what's your definition of value? Let me ask you that.
The definition of value, each guru has his own different criteria for definition of value. In this particular case, it's not a percentage, but certainly when the price of the book is under 2 or price earnings is under 15 or under 10, those are on the lower end of the market in terms of the ratio,
mm-hmm.
and therefore becomes deeply valued at that point.
Right. So he's looking for these. And how, when you run this, what universe of stocks do you run it on?
The stocks listed by Reuters, which is some 6,000 stocks.
So the whole U.S. universe.
Whole U.S. universe, including the ADRs listed on the New York Stock Exchange.
Right, which a lot of them initially cut off because of size issues. Just right off the bat, just chop them right off for the small guys. Those are just out of there.
Yeah.
So when you finish this, what in general, how many stocks are left over?
Well, that can vary from time to time. It could be anywhere from 10 stocks to 50 stocks
mm-hmm.
Can actually meet that criteria at any given time.
So I'm assuming through the recent market turmoil, there was more stocks.
Yes, but... to the extent when your price to earnings goes negative for quite a period of time, then all of a sudden that will violate his price to earnings criteria mm-hmm. and therefore rule out those companies.
Right, I understand. So that's the classic value investor, Benjamin Graham, I mean, clearly the classic value investor where he's looking for long term. Now, why did he exclude the financials?
At that time, financials were considered highly risky, almost exactly as they were today.
That was probably the fifth gyration or five times backwards of the same thing happening that's happened recently.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. We have every few years the same thing just happens again, and we're all astonished by it. But, okay, so now, all right, so that's one. So how do you actually go then? And so how many gurus do you have in the universe of gurus?
By the way, it's very interesting, but... the Benjamin Graham Guru Portfolios we implemented has been one of the very best performers, not only this year, it's up 13% compared to the S&P being down 2%, but since we've been tracking it since 2003, it's been an absolutely outstanding performer.
I would imagine, though, during the big go-go growth years, it was, if you could think about this, it probably was not as good as a performer. And I'm sure back in 1997, 8, and 9, when value was really out of favor, it really wasn't a great deal. I'm thinking out loud about that. I mean, that would make sense to me.
Yes, there was a few-year period of time, particularly during the internet craze, when value was out of favor. It really wasn't going anywhere, particularly when compared to the growth stocks.
Yeah, I remember all the really big value houses back then decided they need to buy growth players. Do you remember that?
I remember that very well. And what was interesting is... that persisted for so many years, past 3 years, that quite a lot of value managers were basically fired. Those that stuck to the guns were finding it extremely hard to defend against their clients. Yet when you finally look at what happened in history after you got through the 2000-2001, value again over that time period came out far higher.
Yeah, no, it's a classic rotation. Listen, Bill Miller is going to be right eventually.
That's correct.
I mean, he was right for a while, he was wrong, and he just says it doesn't matter. If he's wrong, he still says the same thing. He said it recently, that financials are going to be the very best investment over the next 3 years. Now, at any given time in history, he would say the same thing. And he's right sometimes, and he's not right sometimes. And sometimes he's so wrong that it's horribly just, it's horrible to even look at it. It's almost like it's disturbing. On the other hand, when he's right, after the time when it bottoms out to absolutely just horror show, it looks beautiful. You know,
it's something very interesting because across all the gurus, they pretty much consistently stuck to their strategies.
Mm-hmm.
If they were a growth investor, they stayed a growth investor, even when value was in favor, and vice versa.
But I think they have to do that, don't they, a little bit, John? I mean, the fact is that they can't start switching around with strategies because it confuses people. I mean, people were attracted to them, their investors, because of their strategy. And over time, you know, we're talking about now over time. Over time, obviously, the time-tested nature of a strategy versus a one-week, one-month, one-year situation is what it's all about.
It is. There's a lot of pressure on the investment gurus and investment advisors when the stock market is going against you for not just 6 months or a year, but 2 years or more, to change your strategy. Your clients are continually telling you that the market has changed. You are just not with it anymore. You're not on top of it.
Right. I'm with you. I mean, I hear that. I understand exactly what you're saying there, because that the fact is that, you know, the market sometimes throws some major curveballs, and truthfully, you know, it again, as I look at it, when I look at it like a mutual fund or managers, I think that you have to take into consideration that it's not everything's in favor all the time. It's just not the way it is. I mean, it can't be.
Exactly.
All right, so let's go through now the idea. So you have all these gurus that you run these screens on, and you come up with, I'm just kind of throw this out to make it easy, you know, a number of stocks from each of them. How do you weight which guru that you're going to use in your actual portfolios for that given time period? So let's say you have, I'm just going to say a number, five gurus that you're using, and each one of them has 10 stocks that come out of their current screens. And let's say that's too many stocks. I mean, how do you pick what you're doing?
There's a couple different ways. First of all, we maintain a 10-stock and a 20-stock portfolio for each of the gurus. What are the top 10 according to their criteria at any given moment in time? So that is the first set of portfolios that we maintain to track them. The second, though, is that we have what we call consensus strategies, one of which is our hot list. What we do in that is we look at the risk-adjusted return or performance of each guru since we've been tracking them, and use that to actually weight their vote in each individual stock.
Mm.
And then we take the top 10 or top 20 or top 50, depending. For our money management clients, we actually use 50 for diversification purposes.
So I recall, and I don't know if you do this the same way, but you would have a static portfolio for a month and then flip it, if there needed to be a change, I should say, the next month. Is that the same way that you do it?
When we were doing the strategy lab, what I would do is every 28 days, that is every fourth Friday, I would take the best stocks according to each guru strategy or according to the consensus guru strategy, and then update my stock selection.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. So which one? Do you have a favorite?
Actually, it's been Graham for the longest period of time.
Really? Yeah. I mean, he's great stuff. I mean, he is the father of value investing, clearly. And not only that, I think I go so far as saying maybe the father of fundamental investing. Would you say that?
I wouldn't know who else to nominate, but I do consider him the father of value investing, the father of security analysis, and certainly the professor and mentor to Warren Buffett.
Yeah, yeah. So what's going on? What's your feeling on Warren Buffett lately? I mean, he's been getting quite the rap lately.
Well, it's very interesting, but our portfolio, picked according to the strategies that he's used in the past, has been one of the best performing strategies this year.
Mm.
Second, he also is a person who is not going to change his strategies for it.
Right.
And he's buying in when he sees value. He will ultimately be vindicated in the long term.
Right. I mean, the thing is as crazy as it may sound, is if he survives through the period, whatever that period was, however bad it gets, that I think that when it does turn, it would be very successful for him. Not that he's going to fail through that. I'm just saying that's if it does get through that. I mean, if it got so bad that he had to come up with any kind of money for those derivative deals that he had, although I guess he took a big write down for him, or if in fact, let's say Wells Fargo went out of business when he did that, or Harley Davidson, or whatever it would be, or Goldman. I mean, obviously that would be a big problem. But if it got even into the down and dirty ugliness of it all, I mean, as long as he kind of gets to the other side, I think, you know, it would look much better, obviously.
Oh, absolutely. No question about that.
You know, it's just getting through those times that sometimes are tough, really tough, you know? So how do you know you? So you have a, you know, how do you talk to investors about the current market that we're in right now? I mean, what do you tell them? Because it's not normal. Let's just say that.
Well, depending upon the time frame that they are looking at. So let's not just talk about the time frame since the March 9th low.
Yeah, no.
But if we go back 18 months or so, from this period of time where we've had a tremendous credit liquidity crisis. These are extremely unusual times. This has been one of the few times that the stock market has actually retracted back in excess of 50%.
Mm-hmm.
This has been one of the very few periods of time when over 10 years investing in the stock market has not made money.
Right.
That's certainly extremely
yep.
unusual.
Uh-huh.
But what I also tell my clients is that when this has happened, the subsequent, whether it's 1 year or 10 year period, it does phenomenally well.
Yeah, you're coming off a bottom, you're coming off a low.
Rebound effect,
yeah.
right.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the GDP numbers that we're looking at. I mean, why is GDP going to look good in two quarters from now? Because it's coming off zero, essentially. It's coming off a negative. So if you have even a little bit of movement, it's going to be positive.
That's exactly right.
You know, so it's just a numbers game, obviously. But the question is, what side of the number are you on? I mean, you know, staying through the whole thing or, you know, in on the other side. So do you think that this market condition that we've had over the last, I don't know, whatever it is, you said 18 months, I guess, the 18-month period. You know, I looked at something recently, and I was interested. I said, you know, if the market right now kind of just got back to just kind of from this point exactly right now, just kind of leveled off and did its normal, whatever normal is, but its normal kind of thing that, you know, not this craziness, right? It would be a relatively short period of market disturbance, even as compared to the 2000 through 2002. It's only been a year, little less than a year and a half. In fact, it's been through, let's just say, the summer of 2008, which is not even a full year yet.
Well, yes and no. You're right, particularly compared to that 2000-2003 period of time when the market was just going down, 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 down.
Right.
But nevertheless, when you look at all the recessions, this is actually more than average in terms of recession. The typical recession is 13 months. I think we're at 17, 18 months.
Oh, no. Yeah, we actually did a study on this. Since the longest ones happened in the late 1800s. But post the Great Depression, you know, kind of modern times, if you will, this will be the longest recession that we had, if it stopped right now. I mean, it would still be the longest
right.
recession. And I think that deservedly so, by the way. I mean, from everything that we know, from everything that we've been told, it should be the longest recession from all those times. And, you know, I think that the, you know, the question then remains, will we have, and I don't know if we can answer this, but, you know, will we have a V recovery? I don't see how that's possible. We have a U recovery, possibly, an L recovery, possibly. But I wonder, you know, what the long-term effect on investors. A lot of investors are kind of, I think, have become quite disillusioned by the stock market, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And I wonder, you know, that all the gains, you know, if you think about the S&P 1400, and just as a number, but the S&P top line 1400, that was built on a lot of excess equity from homes and money that was put in, money that since have either evaporated or no longer available for a second go-round. And I just wonder, you know, where this whole thing goes to from now. Not stock by stock, I'm not talking about. I'm just talking about market in general. You know, when we look back to 2000, was the NASDAQ still down 50% or something like that from 2000's high, right?
Yep.
I mean, that's a pretty big kind of, I think it went down 75% at the low in 2002 or so, or maybe it was after that. But so let's talk about the book for a moment, the Guru Investors. You go through each of the gurus in the book, right? You go through the different techniques, we can call.
Yeah, explaining what makes them the gurus and some unique, interesting facts about them. And then step-by-step how they went about picking stocks. It's very educational for somebody who wants to do fundamental analysis and understand exactly how the gurus thought of things and whether they considered a price-earnings ratio or they didn't or how they considered growth and quite a number of factors.
So have you ever thrown a guru out?
No, actually have not thrown a guru out. We still maintain and monitor their performance. Over time, we slowly have added gurus after we track them usually for several years internally.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So is there any gurus that you would say, oh, well, they're not in my list right now. I'd love to have them as one of the gurus in what I'm doing or somebody that you track that maybe you haven't told us about yet?
No.
Aside from me. Hold on a second.
Wait.
You know, of course.
Yes, excited for you,
yeah, of course, of course.
nothing that I've disclosed publicly.
Okay. All right. So The Guru Investor, I think that it's a great book. It's available at Amazon.com, your local bookstores, all that. I would check out John's website, Valadia.com. We'll put links on the website in the Disciplined Investor in the show notes to get to John. I would encourage you. John is chock full of information. He's a great writer, and I think that your understanding of securities and fundamental analysis and all that is just superb, and I'm glad that you have joined us today.
Thank you so very much, Andy.
All right, thanks. I'll talk to you soon, John. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
And with us now is the founder and the editor of footnoted.org, Michelle Leader. It's footnoted.org, right, Michelle?
Yes, it is.
So you do a lot of work going through the massive amount of filings that come out. You're just kind of ending with the earnings season. And what are the kind of things that you look for and report on?
I'm looking at all sorts of things. You know, I like to look at compensation. I like to look at perks. I like to look at unusual disclosures. I like to look at new disclosures. You know, just earlier today, I thought this was kind of interesting. It was actually in a filing yesterday, but I wrote about it today. Shearing Plough came out with its S-4, which is, you know, a filing that is required when a company is being acquired. And there were all sorts of really interesting details in there, including the fact that, you know, Merck wasn't the only suitor for Shearing Plough. There was another company that they identified as Company X. That's a new detail.
Right. So when you know, I'm going through, you do also write for, or this is brought in through Deal Book, and they reference you quite often. And I thought it was interesting, many of the things that you had. For example, this was a piece that you found, and this is great because, I mean, I don't think, you know, when we look at the earnings report, usually looking at what, the first three sentences, right? Something to the effect of, you know, XYZ company, you know, beat earnings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then it's when you get into the details. Well, how'd they really beat, you know? So here, and then what else is behind the scenes? And you're talking here about Skechers, and you talk about that in one of the filings that Skechers did, I guess it was the CEO. Oh, wait a minute, what was the CEO?
The president.
The president. What?
So he's a family, you know, it's a family relationship. And, you know, I mean, they purchased, you know, I mean, I think that you see all sorts of crazy things. I mean, they spent $140,000 to buy a car from the president of the company. Now, and they said that they bought that at cost. Now, I have to, you know, profess I'm not usually in the market for $140,000 cars. I drive Camrys, which are considerably cheaper. So I'm not exactly sure what $140,000 buys you in terms of a car.
Right.
But that's a really nice car.
And that
buy,
wasn't
like,
really
about seven Camrys for that.
Yeah, that wasn't quite the arm's length transaction, probably, right?
Doesn't seem like it. And you see other things like that, too. I mean, look at Chesapeake Energy, for example. You know, they had a transaction with, you know, their chairman and CEO, Aubrey McClendon, that I wrote about quite a bit. You know, they bought $12.1 million worth of antique maps from him, you know, and the dealer. I mean, you just see sorts of all these sorts of crazy things. Now, maybe, you know, maybe that $12.1 million was a great price for this map collection. Again, nothing I know about. But you just got to wonder when you start seeing these crazy sorts of transactions. When the company is, you know, buying, when the CEO has a company, I should say, that provides corporate, you know, plane service to the CEO, and it's owned by the CEO and is doing business with the company. Anytime you have these large public companies or even, you know, moderately sized public companies doing business with private companies that are in some way, shape, or form tied to the company, you know, tied to a senior executive, that's when you really want to be paying closer attention. And, you know, I'm going to point out a great example to you, Andrew. I mean, this is actually 5 years ago when I first started really getting into this whole, you know, thing. I saw some very interesting disclosures in a Krispy Kreme filing. And, you know, there was all about these, you know, buying franchisees and, you know, related parties and all sorts of things like that. And I was wondering, this just didn't sound like it didn't sound, you know, kosher to me, for lack of a better word. And I started looking at it. You know, the stock was trading at like over $40 a share. This was in, you know, September of 2003. So if you go back and look at, you know, a quote for Krispy Kreme in September of 2003, you'll see the stock was trading around around $40 a share. And we know what happened to that company. And, you know, a lot of it had to do with those related party transactions. You know, companies will disclose, the key thing that I stress when you're looking at SEC filings, companies are required to disclose all sorts of things in these SEC filings, but there's no requirement that they have to tell you what's in there or that, you know, and there's no easy way to get through it other than to sit down there and read it.
Well, do you think that, I mean, you've been doing this a long time, and is it, does it seem to you that, I don't know if it's more recently than not, that companies deliberately try to obfuscate many of the details to totally confuse and confound so that you really have, you know, very difficult time to make a decision or to understand what they're saying?
I don't know if they totally do that. I think that they go out of their way to bury it in, you know, a very detailed, you know, I mean, I've seen companies, I can't remember which one it is, quite frankly, but there was a company that put out a 10K, you know, 10K being the annual report, and I'm not talking about the glossy annual report that you get, you know, mailed to you, but it was close to 1,000 pages.
Wow.
Now, I don't know who was going to read that. I certainly wasn't going to read it, you know, I mean, you just got to wonder if even the attorneys who are being paid to put together this stuff are reading that type of thing. It might have been Blackstone. I can't remember, but I don't want to say for sure.
Yeah.
But it was a company, and I remember looking at it. It was a 1,000-page 10-K. You know, so I think that, you know, there's all sorts of ways that you can bury things. And, you know, one of my favorites is to look at things that are, you know, printed on, you know, filed late on a Friday night, Friday afternoon. You know, tomorrow, for example, it's the day before Memorial Day, right? The markets are closed on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
I would expect, bonanza of filings to come in, you know, around 4 o'clock tomorrow after the market closes, and the market will be closed for the next 3 days, and, you know, people will be sitting in the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And I would expect all sorts of interesting disclosures to come out. It's just like a typical, it's just a great time to do that.
I mean, I don't know, and call me picky,
mm-hmm.
but that doesn't give me a really good feeling, a warm fuzzy for investing in a company.
Well, but I think there are, you know, you start to see patterns with the companies that really try to, you know, do this sort of thing, go out of their way, you know, to seem to be, you know, in it for them, so to speak. I mean, there are well-managed companies, and there are companies, I mean, this past year we saw a number of companies that said, you know, and good for them, quite frankly, they should have done this before, oh, we're not going to give a gross-up on, the family usage of the company's corporate jet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know how many of your listeners know what a gross-up is, but basically you and I, if we get some kind of perk, we have to pay taxes on that. We have mm-hmm. to declare it on our income
mm-hmm.
in some way, shape, or form. But when a CEO or another top executive gets a particular perk, let's say, you know, $1.1 million in personal usage of the corporate jet, the company is actually giving them another chunk of money to make up the taxes that they would have had to pay on that.
Right.
That's a tax gross-up.
Right.
And you started seeing this year for the first time, really, that I can remember, companies saying, or, you know, executives saying, I'm going to forego that gross-up. Mm-hmm. One that comes to mind, for example, is a top executive of Morgan Stanley who was getting, was being paid, basically, because he lives in Washington, D.C., and Morgan Stanley, of course, is based in New York. And so the company was paying for him to commute between Washington and New York, and I forget what the exact number was. I had written about this for the Times and Deal Book. But on top of whatever that amount of money was, he was also getting a tax gross-up. I believe the tax gross-up was around $50,000.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he was going to no longer accept the tax gross-up. So he was mm-hmm. going to still take the, you know, corporate jet to come commute back and forth, but he was no longer going to get the tax gross-up on it. He was going to actually pay his tax bill.
Yeah. Well,
so you're starting to see now, I mean, you could say, oh, that's mighty big of you, if you were being a true cynic.
Right, right, right.
But, you know, you can also see that companies are starting to, you know, recognize that, you know, some of this behavior really looks reprehensible to the average person. You know, if I was to, you know, take a vacation tomorrow and head off to, I don't know, Paris, you know, for the weekend, I would have to pay for that airfare and all of my expenses. But a lot of these companies, you know, a lot of executives at these companies are not. They'll rig a business meeting and they'll call it a business expense.
I've seen crazy things. Yeah, this is like what happened with when the big three automakers came to Washington on their jets, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the big hoopla and, oh my gosh, I can't believe. So what they do the next time they drove, and not only did they drive, but they informed the press to be there to tape the driving,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, I just find that it's become, for whatever reason, so complicated. Many of the numbers, I mean, right now we're in towards the end of, if not the end of earnings season, which was just probably one of the most bizarre earnings seasons that I've ever seen in terms of not knowing every single time an earning came out, you know, why was it that they did in fact beat? Was it an analyst was off? Was there something that was, a line that was changed to, for example, the mark-to-market type of question? And more so than ever, I think that, you know, companies have been in a very difficult time and many of them fighting for survival, let's be honest, have, you know, we almost have to watch them because it's become an art to put out the corporate press release, whereas it used to just have information. Now it's more of a marketing piece than it is an informational piece. Don't you agree?
Yeah, to a large extent. And then, you know, you start seeing some of these companies that are starting to use Twitter and, you know, social networking platforms like Facebook to do this stuff. I mean, it was very interesting. I was in Denver, I guess about 3 weeks ago, at a business editors, a conference for business editors and writers, and Mary Shapiro spoke. And after the after her speech, I had a chance to ask her a question about this whole thing about, you know, using some of these new social media platforms. I mean, today, for example, the SEC came down on a group of investors who connected on a website called Investors Hub that were using, you know, a website to, you know, pump up stocks. And, you know, you have all sorts of interesting, you know, technology meshing with investing, and there's a lot of interesting questions out there right now.
You know, that's interesting that you mentioned that, because there's a couple of groups in particular that I have some friends, as a matter of fact. They started a Twitter-style stock, I don't know if it's recommendation or informational type of thing. Now, maybe not them or another, but, you know, it's interesting to me that it seems that once you cross the line of writing, recommending, or you know, saying it's no good, anything about a stock, there's disclosure issues that are now a problem. I mean, how do you actually do that on Twitter, for example? I mean, it seems to me that there's inherent you know, reason why somebody would want to spread the news of why they're buying a particular stock, and probably it's for their interest.
Absolutely. Or why they're shorting a particular stock. I mean, that's something, you know, as well, that you're starting to see people, you know, I mean, I participate on Twitter, and I'm getting a Twitter stream all day, and there's people chattering all day long about, you know, stocks, you know, going up, going down, they're pieces of garbage, they're, you know, the next best thing, you know, they're going to do everything for you. So, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's a very interesting time. I mean, to a certain extent, some of this has replaced, you know, the online message boards, you know, that we all became used to on Yahoo and, you know, maybe even earlier Raging Bull and so on. So, you know, a lot of, it's just interesting to watch this technology converge in the investing space and how it's being adapted and how companies are even using it. I mean, eBay, for example, you know, I mean, a lot of CEOs now have corporate blogs where they're posting things. You know, eBay has a corporate Twitter account where they're posting things as well. So,
but Michelle, we run into problems there. There was a situation a few years ago, if you recall. First of all, the ability to be the anonymity, you know, of a Twitter account. I mean, anybody could sign up with any name and say whoever you want to be or not.
Yeah.
There was that case where I believe it was the CEO of, now I can't remember what company it
was.
Whole Foods. Yes, thanks. That was weird.
That was weird.
That was really weird. Where the Whole Foods, he was under a pseudonym. He was coming on and talking about the company, but it wasn't. He wasn't saying who he was and all that. I mean, that's a big. Well, not that situation, but that's a big problem. I mean, you know, really, you talk about, you know, PR, and PR teams could really now pose as anyone, and start recommending a stock or spreading a basic, I mean, and really there's no way to trace this anymore.
And, you know, I mean, I guess to a certain extent it is traceable. I mean, if you really start creating some damage, I'm sure they can go after you via your IP address. I mean, you know, the average person.
Assuming you don't spoof it or mask it. Okay. Yeah,
exactly. But I mean, I think there's probably some ways that I'm probably not even aware of that you can, you know, I'm sure law enforcement knows ways to go about doing that, but they probably wouldn't want to share it with the average person, or at least I'm assuming that. But anyway, I think that, you know, it is an interesting, it's definitely, you know, some weird stuff going on. And I, you know, I mean, I worry about that. You know, you look at a site like, you know, about a year or so ago, there was an incident with Seeking Alpha, which is a hugely popular site. And there was a guy who went on, and he said that, you know, he was a hedge fund manager. And, you know, he was talking, I think he was talking down a particular stock. He was basically saying the stock is a piece of garbage, here's why, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, the price, I think it was a company with Microvision, and I think that, you know, the stock started falling pretty dramatically. And, you know, I mean, did the guy, you know, was he a hedge fund manager? Who the heck knows?
Yep.
I mean, you know, it's you know, on there's that famous New Yorker cartoon on the internet, you know, nobody knows you're a dog, right?
Right, exactly.
So, you know, I think that it's basically you have to, it's buyer beware. I mean, I certainly participate in the internet and, you know, I have a site that's up there and everything like that. And I think that, you know, if I was an investor, when I'm looking, you know, at another site or another comment, you got to weigh it and you got to say, is this real? Does this seem legitimate? You know, don't just any information that you get for free is probably worth what you paid for it, quite frankly.
Right.
You know, and if you don't ask yourself questions, I mean, you know, look, just the other day, there was that story in the Wall Street Journal about these really sophisticated investors on the Madoff thing. I mean, I was just shocked about this.
Mm-hmm.
They were saying that, like, you know, they were expected 950% returns. And they didn't think something was up?
No.
I mean, hello?
Yeah, right, exactly.
You know? I mean, where do you expect a 950% return?
Right, right, exactly.
You know? Where?
I'm hearing you. Stanford.
You know? And
Stanford,
you just wonder
Stanford.
About this. It's like, you know, ask yourself, do the you know, I mean, you know, we all have our own internal sort of, you know, BS meters, for lack of a better word. You know, and ask yourself, does this seem real to me? Don't just take everyone else's word for the gospel. I think that's where we start to get into trouble.
Well, I mean, that's what's going on with this current rally, what everybody's wondering. I mean, everybody wants to participate, and whether or not it's quote-unquote real or not and all that discussion that's going on, the fact is it just something doesn't smell right about some of this. Not all of it. Some of it. Some of it smells.
Well, I mean, you have some definitely funky numbers in there. I mean, you have the other, you know, the other rule on, you know, how earnings, net income isn't really net income this quarter because they're, you know, changing it so that you have, you know, the earnings related directly to the company and the earnings that are, you know, related to, you know, indirect investments. So you have that going on. You have mark-to-market. You have a number of different things that are going on that are making these numbers, let's say, not necessarily an apple. I mean, if you were to take the numbers this quarter and compare them directly to the first quarter, you're going to come up with some very, you know, stark comparisons.
So my question I ask you, so let's say that, you know, we do have a situation where numbers are, let's just say, questionable on a company. And it comes out, and it looks really, you know, great. But, you know, the person, the institutional investor should be aware of why there's a divergence or differential in that number. They should, you know, you would think so. But do you think that what's happening right now is that they're buying it anyway? They're just going after it anyway, saying, I don't really care. I mean, I'm going to just ignore this because it seems like everybody else probably is not going to know what this is and what the heck. We'll just kind of, you know, ignore the situation. I mean, or what? Because there is some odd things coming out on a continual basis. You know, like when Citi came out and said they're going to be, you know, profitable this quarter, and we're all saying, how is that going to happen? And then realizing that, I mean, I don't know. It seems like there's a lot of, you know, closing the eyes and, you know, hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil right now.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some funky numbers out there, and I don't know, you know, as far as the institutions are concerned, I mean, you know, they're obviously a lot more sophisticated than I am, or at least I'd like to think that they are, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think that some of this is, it's really, it takes a little bit of time. We're so used to being reactive. The company missed a beat, you know, and then we, you know, pull the trigger on that. And I think that, you know, some of this you really need to dig into the queue and see what the company is saying. Dig into those footnotes. That's what I'm all about.
Right.
You know, you can't really tell a lot of times from the quick earnings release what's really going on.
Exactly.
You know, there's not necessarily gap numbers in there. You know, there's just all sorts of things going on. You really need to, like, you know, dig into the documents. So maybe you put it aside and say, you know what, that number looks a little bit odd to me,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, I'm not going to react right this second.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with just sitting and, you know, waiting in a sense, and, you know, maybe you miss an opportunity, granted,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, you can also be, there's such a thing as being a little bit more of a cautious investor, too.
Right, exactly. Last thing, so at footnoted.org, you are kind of reporting the various things that you're finding, and I asked this, but just to clarify, do you notice any trends, things that are happening, things that maybe investors should be aware of and looking for maybe differently now, and, you know, that give a couple of quick tips on what to look for?
I think that, you know, you ought to be paying attention to sort of the difference that you're seeing in earnings right now. So, you know, the mark-to-market issue, and I forget what the rule was, but the way that they're counting earnings now for the direct investments and the indirect investments, so you need to be paying attention to that. What's actually in there? What's what's creating that number?
Oh, Michelle, let me tell you what that rule is, by the way. Just clarify it.
Okay.
The rule is that if you want to be profitable, just put down the number that's profitable and you're good.
Okay.
Yeah, that's how it works, okay?
Yeah. Sounds like a plan, Andy.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, making it up as you go along,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, you're not profitable.
But I think that, you know, I honestly think that, you know, you need to be, I think the average investor tends to be, you know, they look at the number and they say, oh, it beat, it didn't beat. and then they kind of move forward with that. And I think that, you know, or they make a decision on that. And I think that that's not necessarily, you know, the wisest way to go about doing this. I think it pays to be a little bit more deliberative in your action.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before I pull the, you know, before I press the buy button, I do a little bit more research beforehand.
Right.
I don't
right.
just sit there and say, oh, you know, this is interesting.
Well, I think the reason is because we don't know where the analyst is getting their numbers from. As a matter of fact, about 4 months ago, 5 months ago, we had a gentleman on. He's a professor from University up north, and he did a report, and he showed that analysts usually are really off, especially in the worst times, like right now. They underestimate, whereas they overestimate in the good times, and it's been shown time and time again. So you can't just take the analyst, because we also don't know who the analyst is. We don't know what side they're working for, you know, sell side, buy side. And I think that's a good point. You got to read it. Even though, let's be honest, it may not be the most exciting thing in the world for people, for most people to be looking at is the, you know, the 10Ks, 10Qs. But, you know, there are some goodies. So here's what I'm going to suggest. If you don't want to go through all that, let Michelle do the work. Go on over to footnoted.org. Check out the things that she's uncovering. And I think that that's probably one of the best pieces of advice we can give.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Andrew. I enjoyed chatting with you this afternoon.
Michelle, keep up the good work. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Okay,
bye.
Okay, that was, I think that was kind of interesting that there's so much to, I mean, there is so much to know. I mean, beside all the fundamentals and the technicals, I mean, then you get into the whole discussion of, you know, the 10Ks and 10Qs and the annual statements and really understanding a lot of that. These days, it's more, you got to be careful because the headline numbers and headline information is much more about, you know, kind of the realization that a lot of people won't read beyond that. But once you get past that, there's some goodies that you need to pay attention to, I think. Head on over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I'm going to put up a couple of reports that you need to look at. Like I said, the changing face of the of home ownership. And also going to put up a couple of screens that you want to see. The one we just ran this week was the highest short interest in the Russell 3000 and the Russell 2000 and 1000. But that screen is up for you, and make sure you use that tool over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And every Sunday we have something kind of interesting also, if you haven't checked it out, called Sunday Fun, where we try to put something a little bit on the lighter side, but something that's usable. Last week we put a website that you just, it's amazing. I'm not going to tell you anymore. You got to go check it out over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. If you haven't done so already, if you want, if you're ready, if you think that it's time for someone to be maybe managing your money and you like what we've been talking about, head on over to the site. Take a look at the virtual tour. It's a 14-minute discussion of what we do. We're having some great success with our investments. And if you have either getting too tired of it, or if you don't understand about how to do arbitrage and how to do you know, shorting and hedging, that's what we do all the time. And one of the great things that we do is that we have a private blog for our clients that you can participate in and find out what we're doing, how we're doing it. So it's a great learning experience as well. Gone are the times of just kind of throwing your money into a mutual fund and just forgetting about it, I think. You know, maybe it's time to check out the Disciplined Investor Growth Strategy, Managed Growth Strategy, that is. Anyway, we're going to wrap it up here. Until next time, I think we're going to have a very good guest. I think we're going to have David Rosenberg on next week. We'll see how that goes. In the meantime, I hope you have a great weekend. I'll see you soon. Thanks for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.